This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we have got a very special guest, an old friend, both of me and of this show, and I am happy to say one of the most important people in the whole field. And what field do I mean? You'll have to think, figure that out for yourself. If it's deep and important, Peter Lavenda knows about it more than we do, most of us. He is one of the most unusual and penetrating researchers working on the dangerous edge where history, politics, intelligence, occult, and the UFO mystery all kind of meet. He's the author of Unholy Alliance, which is the first book I encountered of his. It's an absolutely stunning view of Nazi occultism. He has been into some incredible places, including a Nazi enclave in Chile that he was later an important factor in ending. He's a truly remarkable man. I really could go on and on introducing him, but he's also one of the most informed alchemists. Are you? What I wouldn't call you an alchemist. That's not right. Now, welcome, Peter, by the way. Glad to have you on the show.
Thank you. Good to be here. Alchemist, in a very loose way, maybe, perhaps.
Yeah. You know? But you know a great deal about it because we've had some discussions about it over the years. Mm-hmm. One discussion on this show was mind-blowing. And folks, if you're a subscriber, you can just go to the search engine, search the words Peter Lavenda, and you will get a group of one of the most extraordinary interviews we've ever done. And as we work more toward an AI powered search, you'll soon be able to really get deeply just into that. But we're working on that still. Okay, now you really open a door into some of the deeper levels of the UFO and contact experience with your own work. Not only lights in the sky, classified technology, superhuman religions, myth, power, but consciousness itself and its very, very liminal relationship to all of these manifestations that the sort of outer world thinks of as flying saucers from another planet. How should we think? What would be the best way to really start thinking about this whole issue, Peter?
Excuse me. There's been a lot made recently on social media, particularly on the idea that we should be focusing more on consciousness and its relationship to the UFO phenomenon than on the nuts and bolts. it's not a one or the other set of options here. It's not just this binary, we either do it this way or we do it that way. The thing that impressed me the most about the phenomenon is that we're treating it as if there is no cultural component to it, like it's strictly a scientific thing, or maybe it's a religious thing, but we're not looking at it from the point of view of language, of just basic culture. And by that, what I mean is that when a foreign country colonizes in our history, in world history, colonized another country, there was a tremendous shock to the nervous system on both sides, right? So you had let's say the British, the French, the Portuguese, the Spanish, were going to the New World, as they called it, North America, South America. They were going to parts of Asia that they considered they had discovered. And there is this tremendous shock from both sides. So you have people living peacefully, relatively, in, let's say, South America, let's say Mexico, and suddenly the Spanish conquistadores show up. Well, they're showing up with a different language, different customs, with different technology. They've sailed across an ocean. They have weapons no one's ever seen. They have horses, which they hadn't seen. All of this suddenly shows up, and this is on our planet, and these are human beings meeting human beings, and the shock was tremendous. Now, dial that up, right? So let's say there is a light in the sky. There's a machine of some kind. There's some kind of device, and it's there, and we didn't make it, and it just shows up. That is a consciousness problem right away. It starts right there. This is consciousness 101. This is culture 101. This is politics. It's ideology. It's religion. It's everything all wrapped up into one thing. We can't just isolate this and say, well, this is something that only science can explain. Science can't really explain the full extent of it. If they had a piece of it, of this thing in the sky, and they could study it, they would have an angle on it, but they would not be able to describe to us exactly the full extent of the effect that this thing appearing in our skies, over our airspace, in our country, has on the population. This is something which no one else can really explain. We are essentially in the position of the people, the Aztecs, being visited by the Spanish conquistadores, right? So we're basically in that position. And because we haven't really studied these effects in world history, we basically just get the story from the conquistador side. We don't really know what the effect is. We really don't know what changes occur in the mentality of the people who are now experiencing this intrusion, in a sense, into our own world. So
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go right ahead. Yeah.
No. I didn't mean to throw you out, but I'm just using StreamYard again for the first time in a while, and I prefer it to Zoom, frankly. Peter, since I was about to interject with a question, this is the question. We do know a little bit about what happened to the Aztecs and the people of Mesoamerica, because I mean, when you go to Mexico, you can see they were totally destroyed. Their culture disappeared into the nether world almost. But more importantly, 100 years after the arrival of Cortes, 9 out of 10 people, the population had dropped by 90%. Now, you know, we talk about ontological shock like it was something that happens to, you know, professors and scientists who have their minds blown. But it's bigger than that, much bigger.
No, it is. And, I agree.
Yeah. Now, in God's Man and War, the trilogy you wrote with Tom DeLonge, whom I would love to interview, folks, but he will not interview with me. He asks whether ancient religion, modern science, and the UFO phenomenon may be part of a single long story which has connected memories of contact, modern contact, shaped civilizations. In other words, are we looking at something that is not first contact at all, but something that actually shapes our world? Are we looking at the masters of the universe, as it were, rather than a new intrusion? How do you respond to that?
Oh, 100%. We tried to make the point in God's Man and War that we, as human civilization on this planet, were essentially a cargo cult. That at some point, hundreds of thousands of years ago, if not from the very beginning, but let's just posit while Homo sapiens was developing and was sort of wandering around the plains, that there was contact. There was the first contact, whatever that happened to have been. And it jump-started civilization as we tried to imitate something that happened to us that was so existential in nature that we were thrown into this kind of cosmic shock, and that all around the planet, people started developing civilizations almost around the same time. They started to develop agriculture, they started to build buildings, they started to stay in place as opposed to roam nomadically around the planet. We started to look at how do we build temples, how do we orient the temples to the stars. We started talking about immortality, about the gods coming from the sky. And this is what we're finding all over the planet. So we just speculated on this because the archaeological evidence is still being uncovered and still can be interpreted many different ways. But from our point of view, what was a cargo cult in the South Pacific, you know, in the 20th century, people living basically a Stone Age civilization, seeing planes land on their islands with goods belching out of these cargo ships, medicines, food, weapons, tools of various kinds. These people became, it was an ontological shock. Things were coming out of the sky, things that could fly were landing and then disgorging all of this equipment and then taking off and flying away again. So that people started to build runways, hoping to attract the planes to land there, thinking this was, it was a religion. And it still exists to this day. So our idea was that our science and our religion, because we don't separate it, we never separated it until just a few hundred years ago, science and religion were one thing. And that was built around this concept, number one, of getting off planet, number two, immortality, living long lives, living forever, and all built around the idea that we have to cooperate and do this together. I think that at least from that point of view, has been with us for a very long time, and it may have been here since the very beginning. It may have had some kind of a hand in creating the intelligence that now exists on this planet, the strange beings that we are, this composite creatures that we are, where part of us is from the planet and another part wants to get off.
I've been thinking about that recently, of just how radically different we are from everything else that's alive on this planet. We look like, I'm sorry, but we just look designed. We look like something somebody created, because, you look like a very nicely designed creature with your beard and your face. And, you can't have a hair covered face like a dog or an ape at all. I mean, you can't have any of that. You have no hair on your body, and neither do I. Well, some of us have more than others, but, all of us have to cover ourselves with clothing. Right. And not only that, we're highly intelligent. We're so far above the next smartest creatures. Cetaceans have as high or higher than native intelligence than we do. But they don't have these, and they can't manipulate their world. They live in it, but they can't do anything to it of any significance. We can. Yep. And we just don't fit. We're building another world on top of nature all the time. That's what we do. And yes, so
that's proof right there.
Is there any evidence in the past that you've seen that you feel is possibly a sign, whether it's in genetics or in history, of this process actually taking place?
For me, it's been genetics. I mean, genetics has been a fascination of mine for decades. And we did a very long chapter, I think, on that in volume two of the Secret Machines trilogy. We talk about genetics a lot. It's one of those things that doesn't make a lot of sense on its own. Every living thing on this planet, for the most part, we share DNA with it. It's there in everything, and it's just a mathematical formula. It's just a very small alphabet. And after, with these amino acids in correct combinations, we have you and we have me, totally different people. Some basic things in common, a head, a torso, et cetera, basic design is the same. But a slight difference in that formula, and we're all different people, just a slight difference at all. So there was a couple of Russian scientists at one point who were trying to figure out, you know, the math behind all of this. And they came to the conclusion that it was pretty much impossible, that it had to have been consciously engineered somehow by someone somewhere. And Crick, Watson and Crick, the famous discoverers, two of the famous discoverers of the DNA molecule, came out, and their opinion was the genetic code did not come from this planet. They said it was directed panspermia, as they call it, that it was created somewhere else and seeded onto the planet. And there is like a lot of mathematical stuff behind it, which we go into a bit in Secret Machines, that tries to reinforce this idea that the DNA did not come from here. And at one point, I think Contact in the Desert some years ago, the last time I was there, I did a presentation. You were there in the audience. And I showed an ancient Chinese diagram of the creators of humanity, the male and the female, the father and the mother of humanity. And they were depicted as having tails wrapped in a double helix in the symbol of the DNA molecule, which hadn't been discovered, would not be discovered for another 300-400 years, right? And yet they understood that somehow that was the symbol to the creation of humanity. And they were very specific about that. So there was the male and the female, the fathers of the human race, depicted as a DNA molecule long before there was, long before it had been discovered. So there's this idea that we have it as part of our composition. In every cell of our body, we have that helix, and it's trying to tell us it's there. And there are some of us who saw that it was there, understood it was there, kept, you know, like the guy in the Close Encounters of the Third Kind, building that, you know, that mountain out of mashed potatoes. We're there trying to draw that double helix. We've been drawing it for thousands of years. It was a symbol of wisdom. It was a symbol of life for a very long time until we actually discovered its physical reality. So my point is...
Yeah, the caduceus is a perfect example of that, with the two snakes. And in fact, the very ancient description of the spine in the on the west wall of the Pyramid of Unas is another example of that. And speaking of examples, I have to be a good boy and take a break. We'll be right back.
For years, we've been told that Close Encounter is a mystery for governments, militaries, intelligence agencies, officials, and scientists to solve behind closed doors. That's not true. The truth is far more powerful and far more personal. Close Encounter happens to ordinary people like me, like you, and our families. People like us, with hopes, homes, fears, and questions that will not go away, that will only be answered in a relationship between us and our visitors. Transformation 2026 is not a book about belief. It is a witness statement. It's the story of what happened when one family had the visitors walk into our lives and stay with us and live with us for 3 years. They didn't sit across a table from us, but they came to us in many extraordinary ways. Transformation 2026 is a chronicle of that experience, updated with all kinds of new information. So it's a book definitely for today, especially if disclosure brings more contact, which it well may. Transformation 2026. Get it. Read it. Decide for yourself what you would do if something as strange as the visitors came walking through your door into your family's life. That happened to me and my family. And we're still here. We're still here, immensely transformed by our experience. So get it from Amazon. Get it from Audible, read by me. But get it. Do that today.
We're talking to Peter Lavenda, his absolutely epic new book, epic new book, is Sinister Forces, the 20th anniversary edition. We'll, of course, show an image of the book, but Peter, you have to hold it up if you've got it handy, just to show people what they're getting when they buy it. Look at that. This is it, folks. I mean, look at this. The whole massive, incredible book. And it is incredible. It is, quite frankly, should be called the definitive history of the 20th century, as it really is, the reality of the 20th century. And you can visit Peter at peterlavenda.com as well. I was thinking as you were talking about our genetics, there's an even bigger picture because of the synergies between the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, the number 108, which is the number of beads in a mala. It also relates to the distances between the Earth and the Moon and the Earth and the Sun. It's a number that if you know what it, all of the measurements it represents, shows you the design of the solar system. And yet, it's also on a set of beads so ancient that we really don't even know their origin. So I think there is another signature, not only in our DNA, but in our solar system itself, of the designer's presence. And let's get even bigger. Let's get even bigger, because we can. There's one constant. There's all kinds of constants, the Planck constants and various constants. We know why all of these constants are what they are. The Planck constant, which is the closest two things can be together without touching, we understand why that is, why that constant works like that. There's one constant upon which the whole design of everything, the whole universe depends. That's the fine structure constant. It has no known origin. It's simply 1/134. That's it. The great physicist Wolfgang Pauli went nuts trying to figure out what its origin was, and finally ended up in a wonderful conversation with Carl Jung, the mystic and psychiatrist, I guess. I don't know quite what to call him, but in any case, trying to discuss the origin of the nature of the universe. And then when Pauli fell ill and was dying, he ended up in room 134 of the hospital he was in, where he passed on. What does it mean? I mean, where are we, Peter? Are we inside a game?
Mm-hmm. We are. I mean, that's the only way to explain coincidence. It's the only way to explain the multiplication of coincidences that take place, especially around important events. How to explain this? We're accustomed, especially for the last couple of years because of the scientific revolution, we're accustomed to putting things in boxes. And science is in one box, and religion is over here, and culture is over here, and politics someplace else. We do this because science told us that's how things work. We're supposed to be suspicious of anything that's not math or science. And everything else is malleable, everything else is mushy, everything else is soft. It's not hard like math and science. And yet, the deeper we get into math and science, the mushier things start to become. as Wolfgang Pauli discovered. That's why he got into this lengthy conversation with Jung, specifically on the idea of synchronicity and coincidence. We get the word synchronicity from Jung and his conversations with Pauli, because he had to find a way to describe coincidence in a bit more scientific kind of sounding term than simply coincidence. So let's elevate that to something called synchronicity, where two things happen at the same time that seem to be related. As, well, if you know Twin Peaks in the very first episode, you know, our FBI agent is saying, Diane, you know, when two things happen, you know, at the same time, related to the same concept, we have to pay strict attention. He was talking about that kind of coincidence. In my life, that's happened so often that you begin to realize that there is another force operating here that is not easily measurable by normal standards, but that these things do happen. I write about it in Sinister Forces as an example around the Kennedy assassination. Too many bizarre coincidences multiplied around the Kennedy assassination. And I also mentioned it in connection to the famous Texas Tower sniper. You recall that case, I think, very well, Whitley. So here was a sniper shooting people from the top of the tower, but the whole thing had been prefigured in a novel published maybe 10 years earlier. And the novelist actually got even the name of the police captain correct, a guy who had not. This was about 10 years before Texas Tower. It's in Sinister Forces. You'll find it. So it's but then we
listen, there's so much here. We're talking a little bit about, let's go on a little deeper into this issue of what we are. And one of the things, and the one of the first things Anne said right after she passed on and reconnected with me, which I now consider a real, completely real thing, and because it was, and it happens to too many people, there is a survival of some sort, maybe not for everybody, but certainly for some people, and she was one of them. She said, Whitley, this is all a game. And I see that, I can see the ghost of a design in the solar system, in the universe, in us. Do you have any sense of the designer? I mean, when I see these little guys, I think, surely that can't be the designer. What in the world could have designed this? What would want to?
What would want to? Yeah, it may just be it's the ghost in the machine. You know, I think those guys you're talking about are just part of the game. They're part of the design. I don't think they created it. I think they're a feature, not a bug. I mean, calling them bugs might also be appropriate, but a feature, not a bug. And I think it's part of the idea of this, what we're going through now as a culture. We're getting closer and closer to a kind of a visceral understanding of this, because our science, and by our science, I'm including artificial intelligence, computers, internet, all the stuff that's been going on the last 30, 40 years or so, is bringing us closer and closer to the point where it's going to be very difficult to distinguish between what is human, what is not. We're getting close to the point where truth and reality itself is becoming very ethereal. We're losing our grasp on it a little bit. And we're developing the abilities to do the things that we've always claimed the aliens could do, right? The technology that they have, we're approaching it. We're approaching all of that. But people are afraid of, you know, this invasion, right? People are saying, well, you're promoting a threat narrative. You're promoting, you know, the aliens are going to invade, and that's why we need a bigger defense budget. That's not going to work, okay, in the first place. I believe that from what I've been able to understand in my own life and in the study that I've been doing and in talking to a lot of people in all different walks of life, that what's happening now with communication and with artificial intelligence, the whole gamut, is that we have created a pathway for the type of invasion we're afraid of. We have opened up basically landing strips because we are now toying with our own consciousness. When we get to the point where we can't tell truth from lies, when we can't tell what's real from what's not real, we're vulnerable. And we've created this vulnerability. We're rejoicing in it. We're creating AI-generated memes and ads. We don't know if we're looking at Peter Lavenda anymore or somebody's created image of Peter Lavenda, right? I've seen a lot of memes with me in it, right? So it's becoming harder and harder. So you know what I mean. So it's getting to that point now where an invasion does not have to be the classic Hollywood style of flying saucers landing down and bug-eyed aliens walking out with ray guns. The invasion could be taking place very slowly, very calmly, very subliminally through this vast machine that we've opened up to the whole world, right? Anybody who can code can get in there and do remarkable things. And pretty soon you don't need code. You just need the large language modules, the LLMs, and you can start doing all this on your own. So you're creating basically alternate realities all the time. So we're cooperating in this invasion, in a sense. If there is something else out there, this is the perfect way for it to enter the planet. They don't have to use bombs. They don't have to use ray guns. They don't have to kill anyone. All they have to do is show up in our dreams, show up in our consciousness, show up in the things that we think are important to us. Just show up, right? Just show up and frighten us, and then show us how to not be frightened. Just do that to us for a couple of decades, and we'll be like putty in the hands of whatever wants to come through, because we won't know what isn't.
You know, you speak of synchronicities. Just shortly before I started this interview, I was reading a letter from someone who was telling me about how the aliens have entered his dreams and they're controlling his dreams. And I thought, I think to myself, we find ourselves talking about that. Okay, folks, we're going to take another break now. Before we go, I'd like to talk a little bit about what's going on with Unknown Country. First, we've changed our entire format. It's a new website. If you go to it, you'll see something completely new. Also, we're pushing out news stories every day because this is no time to slack off. And we were doing it twice a week. Now we're doing it every day. And I think that we're going to be continuing that. We're hoping to get the artificial intelligence search engine going. I'm close to getting enough money to do that. And so go to our GoFundMe, go to unknowncountry.com, go to our GoFundMe and look there, and you can donate a little bit. We need a few thousand dollars more and we're in business. And it's all going to be so incredible. Believe me, the amount of information that is stored and presently essentially inaccessible on that website is just beyond belief. Okay. We'll be right back. I'd like to tell you a wonderful story. It's a story about my wife, Anne. She passed on in 2015. An hour after she died, she began to come back. Now she's with us, and you can learn more about this and what it means to you and what it can mean to you so much more than you may think. Get the Afterlife Revolution. Get it today. You can read it on Kindle as a book. You can listen to me reading it as an audio book. It's a beautiful journey into a new way of understanding death and life. And yes, afterlife. There's a reason that Dr. Gary Schwartz, one of the great afterlife investigators in the world, says it's among the most convincing cases he has ever encountered. Afterlife Revolution. Don't miss it. We're talking to Peter Lavenda. Peter Lavenda is, of course, the author of Sinister Forces, the 20th anniversary edition. But go to peterlavenda.com because he's the author of some of the most extraordinary books ever written on these unwelcome subjects. And we were talking before you left about the detachment of the mind from reality. And I was just listening to a Substack about, which I'll link to in the show description, folks, from a man named Ian McGilchrist, who is the author of a long, complex book about left brain, right brain, essentially, saying that the left brain is taking over from the right brain and the Western mind is failing for that reason. And that gets back to the fact that, as he puts it, the left brain cannot actually think. It can't discriminate. And when we look at the proliferation of conspiracy theories that make no sense whatsoever, we think to ourselves, how can they not? They don't get it. They can't think. But are they not? Didn't they start with one great conspiracy theory, which is true, that there's some kind of a force in our society, in American society, that's hidden, that is hidden from us, and that is seeks control of some kind? It's the force that made the Epstein story just disappear. And it's the force that the FBI refused to say is not going to examine, investigate the Zorro Epstein's ranch in New Mexico, the Zorro Ranch, and forbade the New Mexico Attorney General from doing that either. No one can go. But you ask yourself, why? What is hidden? I've read somewhere recently someone claiming that if the Epstein videos, which the FBI have and which apparently Vladimir Putin also has, were ever released, it would end society as we know it. Can you speak to all of this, Peter? And I know you can. I wouldn't ask such a broad question of anyone else, but you can come to it.
Decades and decades ago, and in agreement, I think, with John Keel. When asked about the UFO phenomenon, he said, it's a control mechanism. I mean, right away, that throws down the gauntlet, because it assumes there is a control mechanism. And if there is a control mechanism, what is it controlling? And is it just a mechanism, or is there a mechanic behind the mechanism? Is there a ghost in the machine? Is there somebody, something, some entity, which is using all of this as, for some reason that we cannot begin to divine, because we're part of it. We're instruments of that mechanism. It's kind of weird to bring up Epstein and then talk about UFOs, but the distance is not that great between these two subjects. It's not that great. There's a lot of crossover, right? As there would be, because this phenomenon, as we call it generally, UFO is maybe too tight a description, just the phenomenon in general, is pervasive. It's everywhere. It's part of all of that. It's people trying to use that, trying to make connection with that mechanism, trying to manipulate it, trying to use it for their own ends, trying to understand how it works. Occultists have been doing that since the beginning of time, shamanism since the beginning of time. The earliest recorded religions we know were based on trying to manipulate these forces, making the contact, understanding them, quantifying them, and qualifying them, and then trying to use that knowledge to manipulate them. The idea of a control mechanism that's invisible and that can only be approached through personal training of a kind that's not logical necessarily, because it's spiritual training, it's psychological training. The idea of getting into that mindset and then manipulating the forces around you has been with us since the beginning. It's part of our cargo cult, the concept that I bring up. So if we're looking at the Epstein situation and for everything that's involved with it, there's a ritual aspect to it that brings us right back to the phenomenon. That ritual aspect of the Epstein material that we've seen so far, and it's been not great. We don't have a lot of information on it yet, but we have enough to start drawing some very strange conclusions, strange deaths, strange political events that have taken place around it, the strange connection between Epstein and Bill Barr, Donald Barr, for instance, the science fiction story that everybody's starting to talk about now, which I read a couple of years ago. So, you know, Bill Barr being the attorney general of Donald Trump, his father was Donald Barr. Donald Barr was the guy who ran a school and gave Epstein a job as a teacher, although Epstein had no qualifications for that position at all. And he wrote a science fiction novel that's rather risque, right? And has scenes in it that might be considered questionable today, right? Which may point towards areas that we're convicting Epstein of. I happen to have known Donald Barr wrote it. He wrote a science fiction story, right? And he's the guy who hired Epstein to work in that school, from which he jump-started into Wall Street and all the rest of it, where he became famous. But his jumping-off point was this little private school, and he had no qualifications to teach in that private school.
Yeah, the Dalton School. Yeah, I've known numerous people who went to the Dalton School. But you know, when I read this connection, I wondered about that. I really did. Some of them could have been taught by Epstein, actually. He was there when they were there. One of the things we've touched on, the kind of the breakdown of our ability to discriminate. I want to go a little deeper into that. And this is the question. When you look at assassinations, cults, mind control programs, occult symbolism, all of that, and I hope we get time to get into the occult symbolism of Nazism and deeper into that. How do you avoid falling into fantasy? And not you personally, obviously, because you don't, or I wouldn't be able to ask you the question. How do we avoid falling into fantasy and still remaining open to these genuinely strange connections like UFOs and Epstein? Where do we, because I know I have good friends who have fallen into fantasy and can't get out of it. They'll never get out of it. They've lost their connection to reality, and somehow I think have fallen into the service of the very sinister force that is causing all of these things to manifest in our society. They've become its victims. How do you avoid becoming its victim?
That's a difficult one, because it requires a certain amount of training and dedication. You have to be dedicated to truth. And that's more difficult than it sounds. We tend to jump to conclusions when we study conspiracies. We're naturally paranoid by nature. And we, you know, history is full of conspiracy theories, from the protocols of the Elders of Zion around the turn of the century in Russia as a way to go after Jewish communities, right? But before that, the Masonic conspiracies, the Freemasons were in charge of the world. And then it was the Illuminati in charge of the world. And there's always somebody that we think is in charge of everything. And it turns out they're just a bunch of people that, you know, really were not that powerful or that capable. But, you know, they met in secret and they had funny robes and masks, so they had to be the people who were in charge. So that's out there as a distraction from what's really going on, right? Quite often these groups are, they may desire to be in charge. They may desire to have that kind of power, but that doesn't mean they have it. We have to look beyond that. We have to be very strict in our approach to this material. And it starts with being strict with ourselves. You have to know who you are You have to have some grounding in your own sanity if you're going to start studying this kind of material, because this material is very strange. It's religion, it's psychology, it's also science to a certain extent, medical science, psychology, and underneath all of that, there are political connections. There's ideological connections. You mentioned Nazis and occultism. There's a perfect combination right there. You have the Third Reich. You have Heinrich Himmler, who was head of the SS, and at the same time, he was fascinated by occultism. He created an entire division, or took over a division that did nothing but research occultism on behalf of the SS. So, I mean, how does that even make any sense, right? In our very, you know, humdrum way of looking at reality, suddenly there's this enormous amount of money that's being poured into a bunch of guys who are out there doing everything from researching yoga and ancient religions to researching the paranormal. Himmler had built his castle in Germany, you know, as a cult center that I visited some years ago. You know, swastikas engraved in the walls and in the floors, and 12 seats for the 12, you know, knights of the round table, all kinds of stuff that was in his head, Himmler, that he was trying to turn into reality. And this was the guy in charge of the most feared secret police network in the world at the time, right? Responsible for the deaths of millions of people and for the torture of millions more. And yet what's motivating this is Himmler's crazy idea about race and eugenics and some kind of ancient civilization that the Nazis were now bringing back onto the planet. When you have that in real life, in real world, in real time, and it's affecting everyone on the planet because of this, then you have to sit back and say, yeah, okay, let's start taking this material seriously. We didn't wipe it out when the Nazis lost the war. They didn't go away, right? They're still around. The ideology is still there.
Race remains the unspoken reality of American politics. It's race, race, race. It's behind the scenes. We don't talk about it anymore, but it's there. And it is definitely, it emerges out of the eugenics movement of the 1920s and 30s, which started, by the way, not in Nazi Germany, but at Harvard. What is the most misunderstood aspect of the real relationship between Nazism and esotericism? And I don't mean the occult. I mean specifically esotericism, which is different. And you could maybe just briefly give us an idea of what the difference is between the occult and the esoteric. And then let's explore a little further from there.
Well, occultism or esotericism, the very word esoteric and occult, they both refer to something hidden. They both refer to something which is not generally known, right? Not generally available. So right away, we're off to the races with paranoia and conspiracy, right? If we're going to accept that there's hidden knowledge, who's hiding the knowledge, right? Who's responsible for that? So right away, you're already thinking in a conspiratorial way, because you're assuming that this information is not available to you, that it was available to somebody else and they're hiding it. And how can you get it, right? In order to get it, you have to join them, or you have to somehow steal it from them. There's a them out there that has all this information. And that's not really what's going on. Anyone has access to this information. All they have to do is try. You can pick up any book on the subject at all, and it's going to basically give you the entree that you need. It doesn't matter how silly the book is. It doesn't matter how popular, how rare. You don't need to do a ninth gate thing and go into somebody's library and steal a manuscript out and find it out that way. You can pick up almost anything. The basic first step will lead you into that cavern. It will lead you into the labyrinth. Then it's going to be up to you to find your way through. The Nazis were the ultimate paranoid people, right? The Masons, they were scared to death of the Freemasons. Adolf Eichmann's very first job for the SS was running a Freemason library for the SS. They would capture these Masonic temples They would bring all the materials to this one place in an SS building, and they would recreate what a Masonic temple looked like. And they would, you know, entertain other SS officers to show them what they were up against, basically, because they believed that the Masons were this subterranean kind of political power that was controlling the world. The 19th century wanted their conspiracy theory back, basically. But to the Nazis, this was a very real thing. This was an enemy that had to be dealt with, as well as the Jewish conspiracy, the bankers' conspiracy, all the other conspiracies that were out there. Occultism feeds a kind of paranoia. It's based on this paranoia. You go to church on Sunday, you go to temple, you go to the mosque, everything is right there. It's right in front of you. Here's the text. This is what you're supposed to do. This is how you're supposed to behave. But then there's a whisper somewhere. There's a hidden text. There's the Sufis, right? Or there's another sect. There's the Shia. They're doing something a little different in Islam. Or there's 100 different Christian sects all doing different things. And some of them are secret. The Latter-day Saints, you know, Joseph Smith, very fond of the Freemasons, was running the largest Masonic operation in the state of Indiana at the time, you know, just before he was killed. So, I mean, he was blending all of this together. And then you had L. Ron Hubbard in Scientology. We think of Scientology as kind of this goofy religion. But it started in occultism and esotericism. It started with Jack Parsons and Aleister Crowley and all of that going on in California. I mean, it goes back, really, yeah. Well, this is where it starts, you know? Joseph Smith and Jack Parsons were basically operating off the same text, right? It was a text printed in the early 19th century, in the early 1800s, called The Magus by Francis Barrett, the big volume that was just published. Joseph Smith had access to it, and it was basically a rehash of the books of Agrippa, the three books of Agrippa, plus some of a spurious fourth book of Agrippa. These were books of ceremonial magic. Agrippa was fascinated by astrology, the connection between numbers, shapes, stars, ritual magic. All of this was, in his mind, connected in a certain way. And he wrote these books trying to take it apart and discern what ceremonial magic was, what esotericism in general was. And it was, you know, the connections of the organs of the body to the stars, as an example. Astrology figured very prominently in this, but then also magical squares, which are fascinating in and of themselves, used to create seals for various spirits of various planets. So it was magic. It was pure occultism, pure Western style magic that you kind of think of when you think of the Hollywood idea of occultism or magic.
Well, we have to make a pause here, Peter. We're running a little late, and I want you folks who are on the free side to enjoy some truly magical commercials, and subscribers will keep right on as if this hasn't happened. You get to travel through time with me and Peter. We'll be right back.
For years, we've been told that Close Encounter is a mystery for governments, militaries, intelligence agencies, officials, and scientists to solve behind closed doors. That's not true. The truth is far more powerful and far more personal. Close Encounter happens to ordinary people like me, like you, and our families. People like us, with hopes, homes, fears, and questions that will not go away, that will only be answered in a relationship between us and our visitors. Transformation 2026 is not a book about belief. It is a witness statement. It's the story of what happened when one family had the visitors walk into our lives and stay with us and live with us for 3 years. They didn't sit across a table from us, but they came to us in many extraordinary ways. Transformation 2026 is a chronicle of that experience, updated with all kinds of new information. So it's a book definitely for today, especially if disclosure brings more contact, which it well may. Transformation 2026. Get it. Read it. Decide for yourself what you would do if something as strange as the visitors came walking through your door into your family's life. That happened to me and my family, and we're still here. We're still here, immensely transformed by our experience. So get it from Amazon. Get it from Audible, read by me. But get it. Do that today.
We're talking to Peter Lavenda, his website, peterlavenda.com, his epic new book, Sinister Forces, the 20th Anniversary Edition. He held it up for those of you on the video side, but for those of you on the audio side, I can assure you it's everything that you would think the whole massive effort would be. Probably the greatest book about the hidden world and the secret world that lies in the shadows, lives in the shadows of Western civilization ever written. An absolute must read. If you want to understand the United States and what it is, and the Western world and what it is, Sinister Forces has got to be one of the first books you open, and your children too, for that matter. Because unless we understand this stuff, we're going to go down in flames. We're headed in the same direction the Aztecs ended up going, because there is someone here who does understand it. And whatever their origins are, even if they come from within us, which is, I think, another possibility, they bring profound change here, and it's coming now. Okay, Peter, let's keep on where we were, and I'm sorry to interrupt you like that. I really apologize. I like to make these breaks a little smoother, generally. But the question of, I want to ask this. Here you're talking, we're talking about Jack Parsons was an advanced and powerful occultist. He created something called the Babylon Working and then proceeded to found the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and ultimately NASA. So what are we dealing with here? What are these organizations? NASA prides itself on being so open. It's absolutely not open. Never a straight answer is the truth. It's closed. It's a closed, hidden system that's doing things other than what appear to be in the public. What's going on here?
Well, NASA began as a military organization. It didn't begin with this idea, we're just going to explore space, the final frontier. You know, NASA began as a military operation. It was strictly concerned with building bigger and better missiles, which is why we brought the Nazi paperclip scientists over and all the rest of it. NASA in those days was that. It was a military operation. It became kind of civilian later on, and supposedly is only just concerned with space exploration. But in the beginning, it was a military organization, Cold War military organization. We have to really think of it in those terms. And the UFO phenomenon was also Cold War era. This was all taking place during the Cold War, which is when Tom started talking to his advisors. Tom DeLonge of Secret Machines thing was talking to his advisors. They reinforced that idea. Remember, this all started during the Cold War. We didn't know what the Russians had. We didn't know what the Chinese had, for that matter. We suspected that there was Nazi involvement on the Soviet side, which turned out to be true. They had thousands of Nazi scientists and their families secreted behind the Iron Curtain in Russia, doing the same kind of work our people were doing, our Nazis were doing here. So there was this going on. This was the idea that, was Roswell, you know, was that a Nazi flying saucer? And if you look at the documents from the time, there was a lot of speculation that that was true. So the idea that the UFO phenomenon might have been some kind of psychological warfare operation on behalf of the the Soviet Union and some kind of Nazi contingent trying to scare us into thinking there was an outer space component to this? Or was it NASA knowing better, but then reinforcing the idea this was outer space, there were space aliens coming down to attack us? All of this stuff was part of disinformation, psychological operations, targeting us, you know, targeting the American people to keep secret the secret operations they were actually involved with, the secret weapons they were developing, and the fact that they had more than 1,000 Nazi scientists in the United States working for us, people with questionable ethics and morality, people who had not been successfully denazified at all. And I mean, Strughold down in Texas, you know, is a good example, right? The guy discussed that. Yeah.
Peter did some absolutely extraordinary research trying to find the man I called Antonio Krauss, who drew me into that whole world when I was 7 years old and damn near killed me. So I'm very grateful to you for that, Peter. And I still don't, we still can't be sure it's the same person, but it was a masterpiece of research. So, yeah, I think it probably, let's talk about that a little bit. I don't want to just leave it. What happened was this. I was taken to something that was a prototype for what later became institutionalized in the GATE program here and in the UK, where children were basically stressed into breaking through into cracking the cosmic egg, basically. And I think it still goes on. I think there are certain schools where it goes on. And I won't say names because I can't prove it, but I do think that I know of some schools where, even though the GATE program is finished, this is not finished by any means. And I often wonder why it is so important to stay away from the Zorro Ranch. Who would we find buried there? Because I think there are bodies buried there. And would those bodies, some of them, be children who were stressed more than I was stressed and couldn't handle it and died? Is that what happened there? I don't know. But Antonio Krauss, can you remember? Do you remember that research? Can you talk about it? You may not. It's been a long time.
It's been a long time, and it took a long time to get there. Gradually, with the passage of time, more and more documents became available. Archives opened up, and I started to look into South America and found a school that had been a German school. I believe it was in Colombia, if I remember correctly. It was Colombia. And people think of Nazis in South America, they jump to Argentina immediately for all the obvious reasons. But there were Nazi organizations throughout South America, before the war, during the war, and in some cases after the war. So Chile, obviously, is one of my areas that I went to. But I also visited Colombia a number of times. And Colombia had a large Nazi encampment, you might say, just before the war and then during the war, which then they tried to squelch. And there was a school that in Colombia that dealt specifically with German expatriate community. So little kids would go to this particular school, and it was run by a number of people, but one of the teachers was Antonio Krauss. And he was there as a teacher. When World War II broke out, the school was closed, and everybody disappeared. All the teachers, everybody that was involved with it disappeared. Until the 1950s, when it reopened again later, and I believe Krauss then showed up later at that time as well. But there was a whole period of time, World War II, in the first, I guess, 5 to 10 years after the end of the war, when everything was shut down in Colombia. A lot of the Germans who had been in Colombia, of course, then became wanted by the authorities for various reasons. So it took a while for that community to build back together again. So that's how I found out about Krauss. And the fact that he had a checkered career, let's put it that way. We couldn't really find much in the sense of academic qualifications for this guy, but he had political qualifications, which means he was acceptable to the Reich, which is why he was teaching or had a position of authority in that school. And then he was dealing with children. That's what he did. That was a school. for children's. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was what we would call a grade school from I get grades 1 through 8, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think it was a high school, but I could be wrong. At any rate, so that was his focus, that he would turn up in Texas when the German groups were there from the war, when Strughold and his scientists were there at Randolph Air Force Base. Makes perfect sense. He would have been one of the people that they would have chosen if they were going to be dealing with children. He had the credentials and the qualifications from that background. There was more to that, but I don't remember it right offhand. There were more things that linked Krauss in Columbia to Krauss in Texas, but I'll have to go back to my notes and see what that was. But that's what got me onto Krauss in Columbia, was the fact that he had traveling back and forth.
Well, I can only thank you for that, because you know, it helped me a lot to try to come to terms with my own past, because yeah, I know that what happened there happened, even though I have to say, in all frankness, I don't remember it in the same way I remember other things because of the stress that was involved. But my closest friend in the world was recruited, and he was 9, and when I was 7, I don't think you know this because I discovered this later. He told me this just a few years ago. He was in the living room when the two Air Force recruiters, who his parents knew, we all knew them. Apparently, everyone knew them. They were not a secret. And he has, unsadly, not been able to remember their names. I wish he could. But he was there when they came and promoted the program to his parents, saying it was for very, very brilliant children, and there would only be a few children in it. And when they mentioned a Skinner box, his parents said, no, we don't want him involved, because whatever you're doing, it's too experimental. And so he wasn't involved. But the key thing is that he remembers the recruitment. And I don't. I wasn't in the room, obviously. I was too young to know. I was 7 rather than 9. So it was a great relief to me that he had this memory, too, meaning it happened. And I think also probably the name Antonio Krauss is accurate. And the interesting thing about him is he had a very unusual accent. And even though I was a little boy, I still remember distinctly that he talked with two accents. It was German and Spanish accents, both. And I suppose he was at once, when he was in Germany, he was Anton Krauss. And I've wondered if there we could find an Anton Krauss working anywhere in Germany, like at Dachau, along with Hubertus Strughold. Hubertus Strughold was brought to Texas as a hero to help us build our high-altitude sciences lab at Randolph. What no one was told was the reason he knew so much about the effects of high altitude on bodies is that he had put Jewish prisoners in chambers and slowly reduced the air pressure while they were suffering in there in agony and observed them. And that's the information he brought to Texas with him. You know, the thing is, you can't distill good out of evil. Evil continues following along. And now we're in this situation we're in America. It's beset by hidden forces. Dark, evil forces. How, Peter, and we're a little over time, but that's okay. If you've got a few more minutes, yeah. How do we avoid being sucked up in the kind of conspiracy theories and the crazy memes and so forth that are going around? Because a lot of them have some truth in them. How do we discriminate, Peter? Because we have to be able to do that, or we don't make it as a country and as people.
Yeah, I'm from a different generation, so I'm cautious by nature when it comes to these things. I grew up with assassinations. We both are a similar age. We grew up with assassinations. We grew up with the Red Scares. We grew up with the Cold War. We grew up with all kinds of people lying to us left and right about all sorts of things. And so eventually you develop a kind of thick skin and you don't jump to conclusions. And I think in this field, it's just too easy to say, aha, this person did this, or aha, that person did that, or that group is responsible for all sorts of things. I see this all the time now. Somebody met somebody, and therefore they spin this entire story around it. I've met a lot of very strange people in my life. I would not want to be associated with their politics, with their activities, with the things that they've done. I met the man who was responsible for the Bali bombings of October 12th, 2002. I was sitting across a desk from him in Indonesia. I mean, I had nothing to do with the Bali bombings, right? But when you juxtapose those images together, aha, there's a connection. They're linked, right? I met Michael Aquino, very famous guy, right? Accused of all sorts of evil things. That doesn't mean I was involved with Aquino and doing evil things. But so what the problem we have now is that we're lumping all these things together and we're drawing connections and conclusions where none really exist. And if you're a person like me who does a lot of research, you're going to meet a lot of people. I mean, I met Nazis in South America as an example. I met the Klan people in Pennsylvania. I've known a number of people in the CIA, in the military, and everything else. That doesn't mean I'm a disinformation agent. Give me a break, right? I'm just doing my job. I'm trying to research, trying to find out what's going on. But we think now, because we are so paranoid, we can call this person a disinformation agent. This person is running a psyop against us. This person is working for the elites, whoever they are these days. I'm not sure I even know what qualifies as elite anymore. We're broken down into two camps, right and left. It's a very binary situation, right? How can you believe in conspiracy theories and still believe in right and left, right? That doesn't make sense anymore, does it? You can't say the right and the left. If there's a conspiracy, if there's a grand group manipulating things, they're not going to be right or left, right? They're going to be over that kind of silly binary opposition. They're going to be controlling things on both sides or on more than one side. There's many more sides than just two. So you have to get realistic. You have to touch wood every once in a while. You have to get out and breathe the air and say to yourself, okay, what information do I really have? You can't let your suspicions control your research. You have to start with the evidence, work from there. You learn that you used to learn that in high school, right? They used to say when you're doing experiments, right, you begin with a hypothesis, you test the hypothesis. If it doesn't test, then you formulate another hypothesis. What you're working with has to be falsifiable. You have to be able to say, okay, if I test this, what's going to happen? Is it possible to test this, or is it just an imaginary thing, right? Am I talking about angels and demons? Like, they're doing this in Congress now. It makes me nuts, right? The aliens, they're either angels or demons. We don't know what those words mean, right? I mean, it means different things to different people. How can you say that? How can you begin to go there, right? Or there's agreements between different races of alien beings and government officials. Seriously?
Yeah, we're spinning a fantasy with and what's worse, people in authority are buying into that spin. Because you go on most of these shows, and as long as someone has whistleblower status, we believe anything they say. And they themselves may not know what they're saying. Yeah, it's just terrifying. I think to myself, where is this all going? And the answer is not in a good direction. And what would a good direction be? Let's go out on a good note. In the ideal world, what would be a healthy public response to the whole idea of disclosure and the presence of non-human intelligence, et cetera, and so forth, and all of the sinister theories that surround these things. What's a healthy approach to this?
When people talk about disclosure, this makes me nuts also. When people talk about disclosure, and this in the same breath, they say, well, the government will lie. When these people come out and talk about disclosure and they're whistleblowers or they've been in the Pentagon, they've been in the CIA, well, we can't trust them because they were in the government. So where the hell is disclosure supposed to come from in that case? When you say the word disclosure, don't you mean the government coming clean? But when the government comes clean, you don't trust them. So we have to do something else. We have to have a different metric for understanding this, of what this is, right? We have a mountain of information. We have documents. We have videos. We don't trust any of it, right? And because we don't trust it, we're not analyzing it. We're not going to these documents seriously and looking to see, are they revealing anything at all? And let's face it, I'm open to believing that they're revealing nothing, right? I mean, it could just be just a lot of stuff. We talked to John Podesta, Tom DeLonge and I, right? We met him in Washington, D.C. in 2015. And one of the things he impressed upon us was, you can't go, the president himself, whoever the president is, cannot simply go to the Pentagon or to CIA and say, give me everything you have on UFOs. Doesn't work that way. There's no big box marked UFO with a bunch of stuff in it, right? There's classification systems all over government that makes you sick to even think about how to go through all of that. The classification system has been misused terribly to the point where the White House cafeteria puts out classified menus, right? To make sure that somebody will read it because it's marked classified. Podesta made that point very clearly. He says they're classifying everything. And you can't declassify it until everybody signs off on it. Everybody on that list has to sign off on the declassification of every single freaking document, right? So we're asking a lot of the wrong questions, and we're asking some of the wrong people. We're insisting that the government comes clean on this. I don't think the government can. I don't think it knows where half of this stuff is buried.
But, you know, at Contact in the Desert this weekend, Eric Davis, who is, for those of you who don't know, folks, has been working on the inside for many years, said it's a lost cause because compartmentalization has been used by dozens of little entities to isolate themselves from everybody else. And now it's not that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing in the Pentagon. It's that the little finger doesn't know what the fourth finger is doing, doesn't know what the index finger is doing. The hand itself is out of control, not just the left and the right, but the whole thing. It's completely out of control. Nobody knows where the bodies are buried because there are too many bodies and too many burial sites and too much secrecy. Because these people literally work side by side and can't talk to each other. In other words, it is a hidden Tower of Babel.
And we're placing too much emphasis on our own government to do the disclosing. There are governments around the world that are disclosing. They're making good faith efforts to come to terms with the phenomenon. In Europe, in South America, there are governments that are saying, let's figure this out, right? So maybe
France has got a parliamentary conference going. It just went a couple of weeks ago. They're starting their own formal process of disclosure. Absolutely.
Right. So we have to be open to all of this. We can't keep relying upon the Pentagon to do it or Congress to do it because Congress is ideologically compromised in all of this as well. So there's all sorts of hidden agendas that are taking place too. This thing is a mess, right? Disclosure has been going on steadily, person by person, individual by individual. I got my own disclosure a couple of years ago because I had been writing about this stuff for years. I had never seen a UFO in my life. I just assumed, based on the evidence, these things existed. I didn't doubt it at all. And then a few years ago, about 6 years ago, I think 6, 7 years ago, in December, I'm driving home, in South Florida, And I go through this little tiny gate that I pass through, and I see lights ahead of me, and we've been getting a lot of police helicopters and stuff lately. So I'm curious, and I stop the car. I look out the window, and there's this thing, these lights over the car. And my mind is going through all the possible combinations, as you do, right? Well, it's strange for a helicopter because it's not making any sound. There's no rotors. There's no rotor wash. It's kind of close. I should hear something, and it's not moving. It's stationary. I mean, it took me forever to realize what I was looking at, because I'm going through, as a rational person would, every possible explanation before I get to the actual one. And then suddenly I realize I'm looking at a triangle with three lights in the three corners. It's right over me. And as soon as I realize that, this thing disappears and reappears someplace else. I kind of knew where it was, although I didn't see it fly. It just disappeared and reappeared and then kept on going, heading, I think, due north from my position. And I realized, shit, I just saw a UFO. For the first time in my life, I actually saw one. And there it was. And I was too stupid to realize that it was a UFO until the very last minute. Because I'm thinking, this has got to be a helicopter, right? Although it's making no sound, right? At night, in December, quiet, peaceful, it's just sitting there. It's not moving. It's not hovering like a helicopter. It's just stationary like a rock. And then suddenly it's gone. And so, yeah, that's disclosure, right? I got my own personal disclosure. I don't know what the hell that was. And maybe people will say, well, it's an American, you know, secret weapon, you know, platform of some kind.
But what color were the lights? Do you remember?
They were not colored lights. They were like white or yellow, that kind, like you would expect a headlamp. Yeah.
Well, it's remarkable. It happens to be a fabulous UFO sighting, a really
well,
good.
And I told everybody. I went on, you know, to told Tom. I told Jim Semivan, all these guys, right? I said, I just saw it, you know, for the first time in my life. And they were all jealous, of course, but that was the end of it. You know, nothing, you couldn't do anything more with it. It was just, and this is the problem, right? You see it, it's there. And the memory is unique because it cannot connect to anything else in your life. It's out of sequence, right? You live a life from birth to death, everything follows a certain, and then suddenly this thing drops in the middle of it from a different reality.
When it's out of sequence as a child, you forget it. That's what happened to me. That's what happened to my son. My son doesn't remember a thing about what happened to him, but he wrote stuff about it. He literally wrote things about it after it happened, so we know it did happen. I mean, I saw him abducted. It wasn't exactly an abduction. He wrote a wonderful note about it when he was 7 years old afterwards. And I've read that many times now. But he doesn't remember a thing now. Not a thing. I think he really wishes he did, and he doesn't, you know, I didn't either when I was his age. I had no idea I had any childhood memories until they were excavated quite accidentally by Donald Klein during one of the hypnosis sessions I did with him. And then it all came back slowly but surely, not a lot, but all of, but most of it. And then the Randolph thing started very strangely. We were my brother Richard is interested in reptiles and things, and there was a reptile show in San Antonio, and we went to it with him. And to return home, we had to go down I-35, the highway. From the area actually of Randolph Air Force Base and just north of it to back into town. And all of a sudden, I find myself on an empty road. I don't know where I am. I don't know how I got there, because I was on the highway 1 second and then I'm on this road the second. And I find myself at the south gate of Randolph Air Force Base. And I'm sitting there thinking, how did you get here? Why are you here? And suddenly I remembered everything. It was an incredible moment. My mind had taken me back to try to rescue me from the trauma of my own childhood, I think. Peter, sure has been fabulous having you on. What an interesting guy. Can you talk a little bit before we go? There's been a lot of stuff on the internet. You know, we were alluding to that, kind of crazy fake memes and stuff that go on. Not exactly attacking you, I wouldn't say, but sort of trying to undermine you for some reason. And you must know about that, or and Tom too, and Jim Semivan, and the whole To the Stars thing. And can you speak a little bit to that and to what it really is?
Well, you know, when Tom first approached me, it was the end of 2014, and when I realized it actually was Tom and not somebody pretending to be Tom, and that took a little while. But then we talked about that. I said, Tom, you know, you're going to alienate a lot of people because you're from outside the system here. You know, the UFO ecosystem is its own thing. You know, and you just drop in like an alien yourself from outer space, and you're saying we're going to solve this problem. You're going to alienate a lot of people. Some people whose livelihoods depend upon not knowing what the UFO phenomenon is, so they can spin it any way they want to. I said, you're going to create problems, you know. And of course, he did. The first contact in the deserts that I went to after Tom came out with To the Stars and all of that, the hostility was palpable, right? And it was just, you know, what is he doing? Why is he getting involved in this? He shouldn't be involved in this. This is not his thing. He's not a researcher. He's not, you know, an experiencer and all the rest of it. So that built up. And then, of course, the New York Times article. And I was on a dais with a panel at the end. That came out in December 2017. So it was 2018 in June. And the hostility against the New York Times was palpable, right? They were saying, well, that's nonsense. They don't know what they're talking about. It's the regular media. That's, you know, we can't trust the media. We can't trust this. And I'm saying, who are we trusting then? We're not going to trust the media. We're not going to trust the government. I mean, it's down to who, right? It's down to a bunch of people talking about space lasers causing the fires in California. I mean, give me a break. Who are we listening to then, right? Who do we need to talk? Who would you trust? And that kind of mistrust has been forever. That just goes on and on. I've done a lot of podcasts in those years. I've done probably fewer now, but I did a couple of very long format ones for American Alchemy and for The Basement and, you know, different places. And I just sit there and I talk. Whoever people ask me anything, I just answer it, right? So it's not like I'm wheedling around. I'm not trying to hide anything. I'm telling it like it is. My stories are, you know, probably by now too familiar to everybody, so they're boring. But that's the fact. Well, it could be. But it's just, I don't know what else they want from Tom, myself, from Jim, from the people working with the disclosure movement. Chris Mellon, who was part of our original group, you know, he's part of the disclosure process. All of these guys, you know, we're doing our best here. The major thing that came out of To the Stars was government people coming out and saying, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. Yes, people, there are UFOs. It is true, they exist. This thing does exist. We've got video of it. We have military people talking about it. It's true, it's real, it exists. What is it? We don't know, but it does exist. They came out and said that, and they attacked us for that. Until Chris Mellon finally said, when are they going to take yes for an answer? We're telling them this is it. You're right all along. And that's my last speech at Contact in the Desert that time. I said, ladies and gentlemen, you can throw away your tinfoil hats. You're part of the mainstream now. They're talking about it. They're talking about it on major news networks and in major news venues like the New York Times. It's no longer this crank thing anymore. People are now talking about it and taking it seriously. Congratulations, we got there. Now let's go on to the next step and figure out what this is. But people have been resisting it. They don't like it. I don't know who else, because I'm not in the military. I'm not in the intelligence community. I'm just this guy, right? And I came out and I did the research and I've talked about it because I love doing research. That's what I do. I love crawling around archives and, you know, looking at microfiche and trying to figure out who said what to whom. So that's what I do. Those guys, they do what they do. And we all came out and said, yes, there's UFOs. This does exist. We don't know what it is, but it does exist. No one's going to be happy until we bring out a dead alien or a craft. And even then, they're going to say, oh, it's AI, or you invented it and made this in a laboratory.
You know, I said to Chris Mellon years ago, the way to end this is very simple. Put a craft, and we have a couple of them. I don't know what shape they're actually in. I know the one my uncle looked into at Wright Field when it was brought from Roswell was a mess, but it was still partly intact. And he said, I stuck my head in it, and there was nothing in there. No propulsion system, no motor, as he put it. Then they thought it was a kite. But it had been performing in spectacularly unusual ways. It was no kite, and they knew that. So anyway, but that's neither here nor there at this point. What we need to do, I think one of the things you should do, folks, is to get serious about Sinister Forces. Get the book. And it's a massive book. I mean, you can't read it. I've read it all three volumes more than once, actually. But if you dip into it, it will take you where you need to go. Because what it does is it keeps you on the true path through all of these things. And you begin to understand how it is that a lot of the fake memes and so forth are actually part of the whole conspiracy process. They're part of the deception. You know, and when suddenly you find yourself talking about thinking about Pizzagate and stuff like that, you are falling victim to conscious deceivers. And you can look behind all of that and find out where they are. But what no one has yet found out is something that we are beginning to realize, I think, that behind the door, there's someone else. And it ain't the Wizard of Oz. It's a wizard, all right. But God knows he's very, very odd. Peter, such a pleasure to be with you. I enjoyed it so much, and listeners and viewers, I hope you did too. And we'll have Peter back soon, I'm sure. One of the greats, you know, they always call me a legend in these shows and things. And I think to myself, now I'm actually talking to a real legend, Peter LaVenta. PeterLaVenta.com, Sinister Forces, the 20th anniversary edition, a doorstop if there ever was one. But one that is meant to be open and read. It will clarify a lot of things that are very fuzzy in most of our minds right now. Thank you, Peter, for being with us on Dreamland.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.